Recovery Samaritan Health Crisis. This is your host, Paulette Young. And we have a lineup of people from that are part of the Fathers and Family Coalition of America 20th Annual Conference, March 4th through the 7th of this year. Shortly, we'll be joined by James Rodriguez, Dr. Carolyn Curtis, also John Van Epp, Philippa Johnson will be on the line shortly. Okay. James, why don't we go ahead and start off with you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Young, for having us on your podcast show, your health podcast programming. I'm going to defer much of what I wanted to say to introduce two colleagues. I feel that our 20th annual conference is really exceptional. We're bringing three senior leaders from the federal government to share new policies that they want across the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration for Children and Families. And I championed and advocated for diversity in curriculums when I met with the leadership last month in January. I asked that they do more on not only edifying their own team members and at the state level in government, but the process to help people learn different approaches to include trauma-informed care processes and developing more holistic, healthy relationship parent education programs. So tonight, we have two of our colleagues who are part of an overall body of faculty coming from Australia, Lagos, Nigeria, Bolivia, Ireland, Scotland, England, Puerto Rico, and throughout the United States. I'm going to start with my colleague, Dr. Carolyn Curtis. Years ago, I had a colleague of mine at University of Washington, Carol Harper, and myself, when we were developing our advanced practitioner credential that it's morphed into now. We talked about the needs of practitioners having the ability to teach curriculums versus learning about a curriculum. And another colleague from Chicago State University, Dr. Bakaya Madison, challenged us to start introducing concepts on trauma-informed care practices, models, evidence-based, and cutting-edge, along with how they apply through cultural diversity and specifically to the needs of fathers, because many of the programs have been developed for women, PTSD, and other trauma, but not specifically on fatherhood. So I think that that was exciting as we grew, and then we looked at different types of curriculums that we knew that were successful. There are some mega companies out there that are doing great work, but there are also people who are doing fantastic, exemplary work to the field. And so I have two colleagues who are in the cutting edge, yet they are very well known and respected. One of my colleagues, originally from Ohio, Dr. John Van Epp, now in San Clemente with Love Thinks Incorporated, one of the leaders in healthy marriage, healthy relationships, crossing and intersecting with another colleague from Sacramento, Dr. Carolyn Curtis, who founded a healthy relationships program in California, one of the largest and most well-received programs funded by the federal government for many years. And they also took the time to use their expertise, their breadth of knowledge, and just their life experience, both from a place of psychology, interfaith, community-based relationships, as well as executives seeing what works and what doesn't work to create curriculum that I believe will be exceptional for anyone that's coming to our conference. And I'm very excited, and not because I'm going to flip a coin over anyone, but I'm going to introduce Dr. Carolyn Curtis, Dr. Carolyn Rich Curtis, who is a colleague of mine from the Sacramento area and a phenomenal leader and a committed, passionate to the wellness, not only of fathers, mothers, healthy relationships, families, and community life, but the wellness of children through empowerment and professional development of practitioners. So, Dr. Curtis, if you could, please introduce what you'll be training on in your new curriculum that you've connected with, Dibble Institute, because I'm looking forward to hearing what you're planning to do and the creative approaches you have for 2019 and beyond.
Oh, James. Well, first of all, Paulette, thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this conversation. And, James, I am so honored by the great introduction that you gave me tonight. I'm touched. And I am so happy to be part of the Fathers and Families Coalition. I believe that our relationship now goes back about 12 years. And what a vital, important part of what you do to improve the well-being of all of our children by engaging fathers in the lives of their children. In fact, when I first started my Healthy Relationships program in Sacramento, and we trained a lot of people in terms of relationship skills when they went out and called on their parents and in an in-home visiting program, and they did not even invite the father to join the conversation. I think that was one of the more powerful moments in my life in running my Relationship Skills Center, was our local organizations decided to include fathers in the conversation about being a parent to this child. So one is I headed up this Relationship Skills Center for about 10 years. And, you know, when we started this with the healthy relationships, my background as a clinician for 35 years, I was really excited about the possibility of teaching relationship skills in terms of building healthy families. And my great disappointment was that we never had the degree of success that I had hoped. And what I realized was that we never dealt with the underlying trauma that interferes with our ability to form relationships, to form families, that families and people inadvertently relive the trauma of their childhood in their new family. And this, to me, was horrific and something we needed to do something about. And what we also found out with a study by Folletti in San Diego was that just about everybody, he found that at least two-thirds of people in a study with 17,000 people, two-thirds of them had at least one major adverse childhood experience. And that did not include things like poverty and natural disasters and racism, all of these other kinds of traumas. And all of these interfere with our ability to form relationships, to get along with each other, to learn and grow, and also to be kind and loving, that it affects our behavior. We end up being aggressive or tuned out. And that what we have to do in order to change our community and our lives is we have to have the skills and tools to turn this around. As a clinician for 35 years, I really believe that this work was in the domain of therapists. And I fortunately went to a trauma training, and they talked about the five best things that you could do to overcome trauma. And I looked at that list, and I said, four out of those, five of those are skills and tools that could be taught in a classroom setting. This is something that we can do and make happen for everyone. And, you know, not everybody wants to go see a therapist. In fact, most of the people that I worked with in my community, they would never go see a therapist. So they don't believe in therapy. They don't want to go and talk to a perfect stranger about what's going on. So that wouldn't work. And, you know, the other thing is that we could just get a whole lot more therapists. But, you know, there just aren't enough therapists in the world to to deal with all the trauma. So we needed a system where we could get lots of people the skills and tools they needed to overcome trauma in their life. And with that belief and thought, I took my 35 years of experience and my work with the Relationship Skills Center and pulled together those ideas about what were the things that were most effective in overcoming trauma. And they were things like learning how to self-soothe, developing a way of observing yourself so you can make new decisions, teaching relationship skills so that we can get along, because as Harville Hendricks says, we are injured in relationships and we heal in relationships. Also, we need to have compassion for ourselves about the troubles and the sorrows and the losses and the pain that we have suffered so we can grow beyond it and then have a sense of how to care for ourselves. And we need to have a life of intentionality to be able to visualize where we want to go with our life and our future and then create a sense of community to help you make that vision come true. And that's what I put together in my Mind Matters curriculum, and I'll be talking about that at the Fathers and Families Coalition of America conference. And I think that anyone who's there will walk out with some ideas and will be inspired to move forward, because, you know, the only way we're going to deal with all of the trauma and suffering in the world is to learn how to take care of ourselves and to learn how to care for each other. And with that, we'll be able to overcome the trauma in our lives. And we can do it if we all work together. So that's
Dr. Curtis,
my plan
could you
for
expand
our conference.
On Dr. Curtis, could you expand the impact that your training has had? We did a training with over 60 Head Start diverse professionals, and I think that people should know that trauma with young children and also vicarious staff trauma that impedes their capacity to work with fathers. Could you touch a little bit about the impact that training, and which is similar to what you'll be providing on March the 5th?
Yes. This curriculum was just published a year ago, so it's just starting out the gate. And there's some very exciting things that are happening with it. One is it's being used in high schools in low-income areas, and in alternative high schools, some middle schools. Also, this program is being used for aging out foster kids that are getting ready to are moving out of the home, and they have to be able to be self-sufficient within a very short period of time. 400 foster kids will be running through this program in this next year. It's also being used with organizations that are working with domestic violence survivors, because they need to figure out how they're going to take care of themselves after the trauma that they've been through. One of the stories that really touched me was in Wyoming, where they had a grant where they were providing services in rural communities in Wyoming, and I was told that this curriculum was going to be the only mental health services available in these rural communities. It's a little 12-hour program, so people could, look at it for 2 hours, once a week or 1 hour a week, and move through it. So the results have been very exciting as people are learning how to self-regulate and not be so explosive. Also to recognize, we also spend some time talking about the kids that disassociate and get very quiet. And so they're not talking, they're not noticed, but they're equally traumatized. So we pay attention to those also. The other place we're now going is that some communities are using this curriculum with their in-home visitor program, that as they call on these families, where they have an hour once a week to teach people skills in order to deal with these families, this is a moment where they can take care of themselves. James put together a wonderful training at Head Start, and what I found is that we started doing these trainings for people to be able to help the people they're serving. And I would say 75% of the people walk out of the training and said, I learned about myself. I learned how I needed to take care of my own trauma. I also learned how I was acting out my trauma with my own staff. I remember one woman telling a story about how she was so very upset about the dress code of her employees and her staff, and she suddenly realized that she was behaving the same way her mother behaved towards her. And she got to see that in a whole different light so that she could now make a new decision about her supervision. So, you know, one of the things about trauma is that it's intergenerational, and that without awareness, without thinking, without having an ability to observe yourself, you end up repeating the trauma from one generation to another. So that's where we are at this point.
And I think that complements some of the advanced practitioner training that we use. We use strategies such as applying mindfulness, engaging families and children, understanding what our triggers
yes.
are, so that when
yes.
we understand ourselves better, then we can implement strategies and integrative approaches and
mm-hmm.
even different curriculums. And that's one
yeah,
of the things I feel like our conference really takes people to a deeper level of experience. And if they use the opportunities that Dr. Curtis, and I'm going to introduce Dr. Van Epp, it allows them to start exploring themselves at a different level. And Dr. John Van Epp has one curriculum, How to Avoid Falling in Love with a Jerk or Jerkette, which is a relationship curriculum. But sometimes we don't realize that we are the jerk or the jerkette because of our own triggers when we're working with others, specifically when young girls or young women have gone through a lot of trauma due to a relationship from a male. And then if they have to work with a father, there becomes avoidance. And it really goes back to that other relationship that may or may not have been their father. And so we want to help our practitioners understand themselves better and then apply curriculums like Dr. Curtis or so many other people who are coming, as well as Dr. John Van Epp, who I want to introduce, and then maybe a conversation amongst the three. But Dr. John Van Epp has some tremendous curriculums. What I like about his creativity is that they could be used for those working with the interfaith community, those who are working in an ecumenical place, working with veterans, overcoming PTSD, his RAM model, which he'll get into more specifically, and how it ties into being a better person so that you could be a better parent or better in your relationship as a partner or spouse. And so John is the founder of Love Thinks, which is incorporated in San Clemente, and he's done a lot of training for, and I'm being a retired veteran, one of the things that drew me to him was this connection of serving the military, because that's maybe 7% of all Americans have ever served in the military, but that's a big group that also comes back or out of service with a big high level of PTSD and many of them homeless. But if you can work with them early, then you can start being more preventive and intervention at the same time. So I'd like to introduce John Van Epp and have him share a little bit about Love Thinks and the two trainings that he's going to do, and he's giving away opportunities for people on Thursday to experience his master training for free, which usually people don't do that, but it's also a way for them to re-engage with him after the conference. So, Dr. Van Epp?
James, it's so nice to talk to you again, and Paulette, thank you for inviting me and allowing me this time. And Carolyn, of course, we've known each other for close to 20 years now and have had a wonderful relationship. And I can just attest to Carolyn's, her exceptionality, both personally in how she has faced her life, been devoted and committed in her, you know, in her service to others, as well as professionally in her exceptional study and ability to present very important concepts in very simple ways. So, Carolyn, it's great to listen to you.
Uh-huh.
I want to start James, I wanted to start where you had mentioned about the how to avoid falling in love with a jerk or jerkette. I mean, what could be more, Carolyn talked about dealing with trauma, but what can be more traumatizing than marrying into somebody that isn't going to change major issues in their life, and you're going to have a lot of problems. So most all of us have been in a relationship or seen a relationship where somebody is really very unwilling to change. I don't know who's typing, but could somebody hit the mute button if you're typing? Thank you. That'd be great. So I think we've all seen this. So let me just tell you a little about this program and try to give you some of the background to it. It's actually a program that is more serious than the title. The title's a little edgy, you might say. And like you said, James, you know, I'll be the first to admit we all have acted like jerks. But there is a difference between, you might say, acting like a jerk and being a jerk. You know, this program says, listen, there are some people that are unwilling to change significant problem areas of their life. And when you get into a relationship, there is both a bond and a binding power of relationships. And who you partner with is going to tremendously impact who you are and how you raise your children and their lives. And the children that perhaps you bring into the world or you bring into that relationship. And it really is important to balance the topic of how to build and sustain healthy relationships with how to discern and sort through the health of a partner that you are attracted to and interested in and perhaps growing in a relationship with. That is really the head and the heart of this program, how to bring together an understanding of healthy relationships and what's involved in them. And James, you mentioned the relationship attachment model that I developed way back in the 1980s. I've had research published on it to validate this model. It's a very kind of simple model. If listeners would just imagine kind of the face of a stereo where you have five levels, like in a recording studio where you would have a mixing board. Know how you know somebody is the first one on the left, and then how much you trust them is the next one. How you rely or depend on them, how you commit to them, and then how you physically interact with them or touch them. So know, trust, rely, commit, touch. These have been shown to be major bonds that exist in all relationships. This program says, listen, we need to help people conceptualize what's going on in their relationships so they can be more intentional in how they strengthen and grow these major bonds. How do we get to know people? What are the key areas to get to know? That would be kind of the head area of my program. The heart is understanding trust and reliance and commitment and even sexual touch. These are all things that bond us in our hearts. But what do we need to get to know about someone? So, Paulette and James, when I was teaching grad school many years ago, I had come across a body of research that was called Predictors of Marriage Outcomes. And I was teaching marriage and family assessment in grad school, and I was kind of interested. I wonder how many studies have been written about premarital predictors of marital outcomes, like what before marriage predicts positive outcomes after marriage, because those became kind of important areas for people who are dating to be aware of, or people that were in some premarital relationship. So I began scouring all of the research out there in this particular area, and I found literally hundreds of research articles that I categorized into five key areas to actually get to know about somebody that predicts what that person will be like in a long-term relationship, particularly in a marriage. I tucked that into my relationship attachment model as like a drop-down box under the no. So here are five target areas to get to know about somebody that really give you a robust understanding. As you learn this program, you also begin to think about those five key areas that you're getting to know about yourself and how it reflects the way that you build relationships and manage relationships in your own conscience. So I put together this program that said, listen, we really need to help people not only know how to build good trust in a relationship, how to have a mutual interdependence, and to make sure that they form strong commitments and manage their sexual relationship and what to get to know about somebody. So let's put this together so that we help people to build healthy relationships while exploring these key areas of a partner. This program has grown tremendously over the 20 years that it's been around. We've updated the research that goes into this program so that it's research informed. We do that every 2 to 3 years. James, you mentioned the military. All branches of the military have taught this program to literally by over 6,000 instructors in the military that have been certified, to close to 500,000 worldwide. We've had research published on it. In 2016, the top-tier Journal of Marital and Family Therapy looked at over 2,000 emerging adults, which would be 18 to probably around in their early 30s. What they found was when they looked at the impact and effectiveness of this program being learned by these over 2,000 emerging adults, they found statistical significant positive growth or impact in every area that they measured. I'll give you just a couple examples of people that have been teaching it. Carolyn taught it many years ago. I was always so fond of how passionate she was about teaching it. Kind of a neighboring town of hers, we had a certified instructor a number of years ago that taught this in high school. So we have a youth version. It's taught in high schools. It's taught in adult. It's taught in prison reentries. But he was teaching it specifically just in high schools in Fresno, California. And in a four-year period, he taught over 20,000 students with workbooks, one guy alone. Man, he deserves a lot of recognition there. So I want to invite you, this is on Thursday in the program, when you go on the website of Families, our Fathers and Families Coalition website, bring up the program on page 24, you can read about this 3-hour seminar and get a little more information about it. But I invite you to that, and it will give you the potential of being able to purchase the complete instructor kit that you can do at home and be certified at home at a big discount. The second program that I'm presenting is described on page 36. It is a workshop, and it's called Home Run Dads. It also teaches the same relationship attachment model, but it applies those bonds to how dads manage the bonds with their kids or their child. You know, how do they know their child? How do they build a strong trust that goes both ways, how they trust their child and how their child trusts them. How do they then begin to depend on their child and form a good dependence and have that child depend on them? and their commitment level, and then how do they physically interact? You know, touch is not just sexual. There is the bonding power of non-sexual touch that is so important as well. So that program also has been taught in the Army and by other branches of the military. It's taught nationally by Fatherhood and Community Initiatives. It's being taught, for example, in Utah, all across the state is just one example. And what's pretty cool about this, one of the things I'll just mention, then I'll wrap up, and James, if you want to ask any questions, that'd be great. But one of the cool things about this program is that it really uses the theme of sports, where you start thinking about how coaches build a sense of strength, of commitment among their team, and to have these kind of themes get woven into the curricula. For example, one of the things that fathers do is they do a stat sheet on each of their kids. And so every session, they think about really the stat sheet of one child versus another, because there's individual differences. So often when we learn parenting classes and go through fatherhood stuff, what we learn is just kind of general, assuming you can do the same thing with every child. But this course helps to break down some of these individual differences by helping fathers to think like a coach. Hey, you got different players on your team. These different team members of my family team need some individual attention and involvement from me in different ways. This is also a certification course. They will learn and get also a discount if they want to go ahead and get certified, and they can do their certification again at home. So all my certification courses have an at-home kind of version that they can get all the materials and watch either stream or some way online, get the training. So I'm very excited to come. You know my passion. I had a counseling practice for over 20 years in Ohio, but have the wonderful privilege of now, my wife and I, we've been married 40 years this summer, celebrating our 40th, and living here in California. Our oldest daughter, who's also a PhD in psychology and works for me, just lives a couple blocks from us with her husband and two kids. And so we've just been really, really blessed to have this kind of a life and the opportunity to serve those that come to your conference, to really make ourselves available to help them feel equipped for the work that they are doing.
And I think that's an important concept. There was a couple of takeaways that I was listening to intently, and I hope people take advantage of Dr. Van Epp and Dr. Curtis and so many others. I think there's over 50 colleagues. Almost about 18 months ago, we have affiliates, and Carol's program was one of our affiliates, and we've had them throughout the U.S., but we also started growing them out internationally. And one of our affiliates internationally came from Beijing, China, and there is a Fathers and Families Coalition of China that is a replication of how we advanced our coalition efforts in the 90s. I gave them all the materials that I had so they could develop it, but what was unique was the University of Peking, China, where the School of Education and the School of Psychology came together because they felt like the faculty didn't have a grasp on how to teach future professionals, including reformed clinicians like ourselves, how to address the impact a father has on child development. And in China, they have a One China law or policy. But the reason why they came to me, and I thought this when I was listening to you, John, their concern about parents holding cell phones and having more time on the face of a phone than holding their own children is what was driving them to develop a national training model. Because they felt that the children were not getting the attachment, the touch, the love, and the bonding, and that young parents were actually bonded more to their cell phone or technology. And so when I heard you, I almost felt like I need to send John to Beijing. I'm sure he wouldn't mind going. But what ends up happening is then they're going to go see Carolyn because they've got disconnection and rejection going on. So the combination of the two could be catastrophic for many, many individuals. So I think that some of the areas.
You know, Boston Medical Center, James, did a study that was really fascinating. It was a field study, and they had, the experimenters, they went into fast food restaurants, and they had designed an evaluation grid, and they watched families, unknown to the families being watched, so they did it discreetly, but they watched families and rated with stopwatches and timers how long they interacted with their children, particularly, so they looked for families, I think it was from age 8 years and younger. So children, they wanted to look at, elementary, preschool, infants, and they watched the parents. So it was all about the parents. How much time while they ate their food at this fast food restaurant, how much time did they actually interact with their child versus the time that they spent on their smartphones, their cell phones? Okay, listen, over 70% spent more time on their cell phones than interacting with their kids. And the theme of the conclusion, the theme of the research was that it was an extraordinary absorption into their technology, not their children, their technology. And what really struck me was they had to create an additional extreme rating for the type of absorption that went beyond anything they had anticipated. So the rating scale that they had developed wasn't sufficient to measure the type of absorption. So it's not just kids into their own electronics and technology. It's also us parents. Just watch parents and how often they are into their phones. And so I think the lesson goes both ways, and we've got to set the example and then set the boundaries, but we've got to live it before we try to get them to be able to follow it.
I agree. My daughter, a couple years ago, they said, "Dad, you forgot your phone on the counter on our way to go to church on Sunday and do some other things." And I said, "No. Is there by intention? I think I know how to drive around without Siri getting me lost." And they said, "What?" And I said, "Listen, I'm going to challenge you to one day out of the week not to use your phone at all. And at least on Sunday, just leave it be, because, we got this limited time for us to enjoy present and be in the present and mindful of the time we have together. Or we could be physically together, but we're not actually together." So my daughter.
Yeah, I was in a waiting room. I was in a waiting room, and I watched these two parents on their cell phone while they had a 2-year-old at their foot, and they were so absorbed with their phone that the 2-year-old actually got no attention whatsoever. And 2-year-olds are really good at getting attention. And I'm going, what is going to happen to this kid as they grow up, that nobody's there for them? And that's, crucial for brain development. It's actually pretty scary knowing that that's happening. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's another study that was pretty interesting, Carolyn. It was, these brain studies. So I'm working on a book on my RAM right now. Anyway, so I'm reading all this kind of brain studies and things. And so it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But, these MRIs, where they're able to scan the brain while people engage in different types of either activities, and then in this case, they had teenage girls on their cell phone playing on the phone, okay? Well, they started with, let me just back up. They started with wanting to see what the brain of a teenage girl looks like when she looks at her boyfriend, different pictures of her boyfriend. So they found girls, that had a boyfriend and, were really crazy about this guy. And they did literal literal brain scans while these girls were looking at pictures. Well, certain regions of the brain were all firing up and they could see all this stuff going on and it was lighting up. So then they had the girls play on their cell phones and they found the exact same imagery in the brain when they were playing on the cell phone as when they were in love with the boy. And they said, listen, you know, the way that we bond with a human or with a machine is the same bonding processes in the brain. This is why dopamine can serve to really strengthen a bond of a healthy love relationship, or dopamine can be excessively bonding to an unhealthy addiction to ecstasy. The same chemicals, the same processes, the same pathways are operating in addiction as in healthy relationship and love. And
we have to be very, very responsible.
We have to be very, very responsible to make sure that we make choices that protect the bonds of our brains and the bonds of our relationships. Because if we make poor choices, then we begin to compromise how we function and how we relate.
And that requires some intentionality in recognizing how impactful this is. I'm thinking of watching my 2-year-old grandson, and when the television came on, that was the only thing he could see and visualize. Everything else just sort of disappeared. And his parents said, well, this is why we really keep our television off, because it just captivates the brain of our child. And saying that again in 100 different ways, that we have to be intentional in terms of how we look at our electronics in our life and how it may interfere with our ability to do real-life relationships.
I'll say something, too, about fathers and their relationships. So fathers, it's really, really important for dads to be involved, to have time. You know, I call it the 3 T's. They've got to be able to talk with their own children, but also how their children watch them talk to a partner becomes almost as impactful as how they talk to their own children. So this combination of how do I talk with a partner, how do I talk with my children, is there consistency, is there a modeling of an adult partnering function, really becomes a template for my child to grow into and to follow. So talk is the first T. The second is togetherness in a variety or in different diverse settings. You know, part of the bond is when you do something with somebody that you haven't done before. You do an adventure, you go somewhere. So we used to always do little mystery trips with our kids. All through growing up, we did mystery trips. We'd be like, everybody jump in the car, we're going on a mystery trip. And it could be something silly, it could be something significant, but we always wanted to do that with them. And now, you know, I have a daughter that just has a newborn over in New York City with her husband, and a daughter that has a 5- and a 3-year-old here. And the one with the 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, man, she's still doing mystery trips because it was so impactful to have the memories of togetherness in these variety of situations. And so both with partners and with children, you need to do that, and then time. And you've got to carve out not just quality time. There's got to be some quantity where you are just hanging and you're just together and you're just kind of soaking it up. And all these things are competing for our attention. And as Carolyn mentioned, it's really on our shoulders to make sure that we are evaluating our lives, growing to have a good knowledge base, but making decisions that really minimize the competition that probably are going to weaken our relationships rather than strengthen them, and maximize the good, the time, the togetherness, the healthy, deep talks that we can have. These are things that are really valuable in partnering as well as in parenting.
One of the things
that I love
what
all of you have said so far, and it takes especially some of the creativity that I'm hearing on the line. With my girls, we used to do something called Pajama Run, and their friends would be over. They put on their pajamas, and then we're getting ready to go out, but you're in your pajamas, but they don't know where they're going. So while you're driving, they're busy trying to guess, where is Mommy taking us? It's so much fun. It could be to 31 Flavors or one of their favorite places or whatever. But the anticipation of where are we going, and we're in our pajamas. It was a lot of fun.
How much fun.
And then the other thing, I didn't allow cell phones in the car. Even when my grandkids come to visit me every summer, cell phones, once you get in the car, or the little games that they play, that can stay back at the house. It's just not allowed. Because when I'm driving, I may be taking them to a different place. You don't even see or smell the roses or, you know, your surroundings of where you're going. So we would play games like who can guess the different types of plants, you know, while you're driving, the different flowers, how many can you come up with? So and that was to encourage looking at your surroundings and what's there and the beauty of what's there besides being glued to all this machinery. I've always, almost one of those always against it, and it allows for communication. I'm Grandma. I don't see you often because you're in another state, so I want to get to know you at this stage. Not, you know, those games can always be played, but our time together, that's not going to be there if you don't use it wisely. Mm. So I love what you're saying. I know you're all of your presentation is going to be great. It's just what everyone needs.
Well, one thing that I found was important is in order to build a healthy relationship, you also need a support system that not all of your eggs are in one basket.
Mm-hmm.
One of the part of our trauma curriculum is really taking a look at what does your support system look like so that it's beyond friends and families, that goes into do you have role models about how you want your life to be? Do you have people who challenge you to be the best person you can be? Do you have other people who really see what talents and abilities you have so that you can grow them? Because, you know, when we're traumatized, we have a tendency to go inward and to isolate. And that puts us at risk for a lot of different problems. But if we know that we have a support system, then we can take risks and try new things and experiment and create something new and different. Because that's what happens when you want to create a new life that is beyond the trauma that you've experienced. And it will feel like you're taking risk. And you need a support system. In one of my schools that I work in, I was really concerned that you know, I was going to ask these students to talk about their support system, and I was very concerned that they wouldn't have any. And what they discovered when they did this exercise was they had more support than they knew. And when they knew they had this support, then they could take the risk. And I was looking at one young girl who was considering going to the local community college to take advanced math classes. And as she realized that she had a support system behind her that would make it possible for her to do that, and by her doing that, she would be the first person in her family to get out of generations of poverty. So this was, you know, the support system allows for a bridge to a new life and to create something new and different for these young people. So that's been some of the excitement for me is, and Ashley, I used a support system to find a wonderful husband for myself because I realized that I needed help and support from people around me to make a good decision about a healthy relationship. And they were wonderful. In fact, I had one friend who said, before you ever commit, Carolyn, I want to interview this person and to give them a stamp of approval or not. So, you know, this was a crucial part, and that comes right out of your book, John, about, you know, if your friends are telling you this guy is no good, pay attention.
I'd say the same thing, you should. Because, you know, love, what they say, that old saying, love is blind.
Yes.
But it's
yes.
not blind
yes.
with your friends.
Mm-hmm.
They can see. I really think that's good advice.
Well, I want to thank. I don't know if our time is coming close to the end. I'm seeing the clock, so I really want to, before it just cuts off, just tell Dr.
Yeah,
Carolyn
you have
and Dr. John Van Der.
But it's on the board is showing like 25 minutes.
So I really appreciate what they're going to bring to the table. And one of the other things that will happen at our 20th annual Families and Fathers Conference. I believe one of the things that Carolyn just touched base upon about support, every year people build professional healthy relationships to support their own vision for their own practice. And I think that is very powerful that people can experience when they come to our conference. And I just appreciate tonight's conversation, Paulette. And I know that you're going to run the rest of the program. I'm going to sign off. And I look forward to being connected with you soon.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I thank you too. It's been wonderful to be here, and appreciate your 20 years of devotion, at least to this conference. Ben, it's made major differences in so many lives, and you know we just always feel honored to be included. So,
John, I'm having to use Just for Men for my beard now.
There you go. And congratulations on your degree.
Congratulations.
That's a huge achievement right there, too.
That's a big
accomplishment. All right, Paulette, thank you so much
for
having
me. But I didn't hear what your degree was in. What did you graduated with?
Oh, a DSW. They know what a DSW is. But
okay.
I want to sign off because I do have a requirement for my daughter to show me her homework, and it's 10 o'clock over here. And if I don't, then I know it won't be resolved in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate Paulette having us on this call, and I look forward to others in the future.
Yes. Thank you. All right.
Congratulations again. And I want to say one more time that this conference, I found people were very friendly. It was easy to meet people. And people were generous with sharing information and and being willing to be invested in each other's success. And I think a lot of that comes from James's attitude about really wanting the very best for every person that comes to this conference. And it's a very unique
experience.
He's done
an excellent job in 20 years, which is seemed like a lot of time, but in that short period, just awesome. When I met him and learned about him, got to talk with him, and said, wow, more people need to know about this. And I wanted to do whatever part I could do to, you know, help promote it with the various groups that I'm connected to.
And I want to say, just like John said, with my Relationship Skills Center, we did use his material, and people loved it. In fact, I encouraged my stepdaughter to take this class, and she selected a most wonderful partner for her, and it came out of the information she got out of this, out of How to Avoid Marrying a Jerk. So I have personal testimony for it being a great class. Yes.
They need to have it in every high school here in America and abroad.
Yes.
Because if the young guys and the young girls can learn at an early age what not to do. And I'm not talking about the do's and the don'ts. I'm talking about actual relationships are obviously very unhealthy. and what they, mm-hmm. how do they avoid that? Most of them don't know. Now, I speak from a health professional, giving them information on what not to do, not the do's and the don'ts, so to speak, but how to make right choices. And
yeah.
what I mean by that, because, you know, I do talk about the HIV/AIDS crisis. Some of them don't understand, oh, you can get it through passionate kissing. They just don't know for some reason. Messages. And when you say that to them, there's a huge reaction, like covering their mouths to cursing. How come no one told me this? It's like that's an area they'll say, oh, can't, yes, you can. They've got enough reports, Center of Disease Control. Now, I talk along those lines about making healthy choices, or whether they're Christian or not Christian, whether you want to do the right thing, you need to know the status of who you're getting involved with from a physical standpoint, because, you know, sexually transmitted diseases is high, and a lot of them aren't in power with the no words, but when you tell them some of the things that are going on, for some reason, they're more empowered. And then the other hard part of that is the parents, the mothers especially, when a parent is not empowered, it's very difficult to teach the child. So it has to be like a joint thing. Because I remember a mother when I was at El Camino College teaching, and a mother said to me, Paulette, how do I know to say no? How can I teach my daughter to say no when I don't know how?
That is a really important question. That is just super, because she nailed that problem right to the core, because you know, we have so much work to do about women learning how to say no. I'm a Amazon Prime member, and I happen to watch a murder series with Boris Karloff the other day, and you know, obvious things have changed as I watched him talk to these women, and he's got his arms all over them, and I'm going, oh my goodness, today that would not be allowed. You know, we would be saying things to him about the Me Too movement, but at that time, you know, women didn't have a voice. They weren't allowed to say no.
Out of high school and seeing, in my case, seeing these black women letting the men do things to them. Okay, this is all like, it was all new to me. Why are they allowing that? That's not their boyfriend. It's not your husband. Why are you allowing that? I remember I did not understand. And in my case, thank God, I had someone 10 years older than me. I said, why are they allowing that? And she looked at me, she said, if they come at you, and it's because I was in school part time and college full time, work full time. And then I had, within a year, I switched that. Why am I here in the first place? But I remember, and she taught me, she said, if they come at you, oh, you got long nails, scratch them and spit at them. I just told her with this girl. Scratching, and I got known as the scratcher spitter, so nobody touched me.
Well, that took care of it.
I didn't know.
Crazy. I have this crazy message from my mother. My mom's message to me was, all men want you for is sex, okay? So there I am out in the dating world. So now, I want you to hear, that means that the only good men are the ones who don't want you for sex.
Wow.
Right? Okay, now, right. Can you hear the confusion here? So men who are basically impotent or gay are the people who you need to be in relationship with, because if you're dating a guy who's interested in sex, that makes him a bad guy. But so you can see there's no real differentiation about what would make a good partner. which is really what the question needed to be,
yeah.
not whether they wanted to have sex or not. But that was the kind of information I had going out into the dating world in the 1960s and trying to figure this all out. I don't know. I think things are still really difficult about figuring this out because our emotions run the show. And as John says in his, you have to have
what you're doing. Not enough male and female are attached to the conference itself.
You have to have a methodology or a way of thinking things through. And that's part of my trauma curriculum is that you have to be able to analyze yourself. If you can't figure out who you are and what you're feeling and what you're thinking, then your chances of making a new decision or coming to a new conclusion are severely limited. And that's how come we keep repeating the same trauma over and over again. And that's why John has all of these systematic ways of looking at things so that you have some analytical skills to make healthy decisions. And some of the more frightening studies that I have is the brain scans done of the Romanian orphans that you can actually see where their neglect didn't develop the prefrontal cortex. So their ability to think through and make healthy decisions are really limited because their brain didn't develop. And that's why all of that early childhood stuff is so vitally important, that we hold our children, that we look them in the eyes, you know, and, you know, let them know that they're important.
Yes.
And yeah.
Don't give them objects and they relate
right.
to a phone
yeah.
or a machine better
yeah.
than they do a human being. That
and
should never be.
One of the more exciting research is that the power of meditation, all of that work shows that it can repair a lot of that damage. So if people who develop a strong meditative practice can heal some of that horrible trauma that they had, from all of the abuse and neglect that they had early on. And so that research is very exciting to see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sounds exciting.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to share with them, the audience, before we get off the phone, the upcoming conference, which is the 20th Annual Conference for Fathers and Family Coalition of America. It takes place March 4th through the 7th. The location is the Hilton Los Angeles Airport, 5711 West Century Boulevard in Los Angeles. You can always go to their website, www.fathersandfamilycoalition.org. Telephone number, 760-578-8661. Again, www.fathersandfamiliescoalition.org, 760-578-8661. This is Paulette Young speaking. You just finished hearing Dr. Carolyn Curtis, who is one of our speakers at this particular conference, who spoke and gave you some of the highlight of what she's going to talk about. One of the things is overcoming adversity and building resilience. There's lots of speakers, lots of workshops. Some of them do have a material that they'll be given out or that you'll be purchasing, books and things of that nature. Great conference. You don't want to miss it. Again, March 4th through the 7th, 2019. This coming Monday, we'll have another presenter on American Health Crisis through Blog Talk Radio. I'll be hosting that. I was trying to remember the name of the person that's going to be coming on. I think his name was Kenneth, but he'll be talking also. All right, so anybody that wants to tune in next Monday, same time, 8 p.m. Pacific time, just call 858-769-4936. Press 1, and you'll be on the air for everyone to hear you. Okay, thank
Paulette,
you.
Thank you so much, Paulette, for inviting me. And I'll look forward to seeing you at the conference.
Yes, I can't wait. I'm so excited about this conference. Yes. Okay. We'll talk again. Bye-bye.